KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, indie film was all about the art until the studios got in the game. How will independent film change again now that the studios seem to be backing away? Plus, watching movies till you drop with the programmers of the Sundance Film Festival. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere. It's The Business from KCRW. A recent survey has got to have executives at the big broadcast networks going into a deep, deep state of denial. According to ABI Research, when TV goes digital next February and analog sets become useless boxes, 3 million Americans may just stop watching television altogether. The study reports that 70% of those who watch TV the old-fashioned way said they'll attach a converter box to their TVs before the digital switchover. 10% said they'll get cable or satellite. But 20% said they'll just let their sets fade into obsolescence. Now, it's possible that a lot of those are secondary TVs in the kitchen or bedroom, but you have to believe that the people at the networks are shaking in their Pradas at the thought of their beloved TV sets being used as planters or fish tanks. Elsewhere, the Screen Actors Guild, struggling to finally get things moving towards a TV and movie contract with producers, has asked a federal mediator to step in. If the mediator doesn't succeed in hammering out a contract, SAG's threatening to send a strike vote to members. You'll remember that the trouble all started when acrimony between SAG and its sister union, AFTRA, resulted in separate negotiations for the first time in 27 years. AFTRA signed a deal with producers, but SAG has held firm, looking for more gains on DVD. Now it looks like SAG and AFTRA are trying to kiss and make up. The two unions intend to negotiate their upcoming commercials contract together, and they do not intend for bad blood to get in the way this time. SAG and AFTRA have crafted a non-disparagement agreement along with stiff fines for violations. According to Variety, AFTRA's treasurer disclosed that the new rules cover elected officials and committee members commenting in private or public on any inter-union issue. The unions will post million-dollar bonds to pay fines for any offenses. In a posting on the web, AFTRA's Matt Kimbrough said, quote, "It is intentionally draconian, essentially giving the two unions a collective time out and resetting the standard of conduct at a very high bar." It is telling about past behavior that these so-called grown-ups need a time out, but note that there is no provision in the agreement about nap time. Finally, corporate raider Carl Icahn has upped his stake in the successful indie studio that brought you the Saw horror franchise. Icahn says he's increased his share in Lionsgate to 9.17% because the company's stock is undervalued. But reports are that Icahn has had discussions with Lionsgate CEO John Feltheimer and Vice Chairman Michael Burns. Now, why would someone with a 10% share in a company be talking with its chief executives? Maybe because he's planning on becoming a bigger stakeholder, or perhaps he just wants to get a good table at the Ivy, or maybe he's got a great script idea. Corporate Raiders of the Lost Ark, anyone? And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next is greed, for lack of a better word, killing indie film. You, dear public radio listener, are the people who watch foreign films and indie movies, and as such, you might have noticed how they've changed over the years. They've gotten more polished, there are more movie stars, and what was once the domain of gritty storytelling and edgy adult fare has been invaded by endearing Englishmen who strip and endearing teens who get pregnant. In short, indie film has gone Hollywood, and that's true both literally and figuratively. In the past 15 years, every studio has opened a smaller studio within their studio dedicated to buying and even making smaller films. It all started more or less at the 1989 Sundance Film Festival with a little film by a then-unknown director named Steven Soderbergh.
Rolling Stone says it's dazzling, fun, and scorchingly erotic.
Why don't you let me tape you?
Then
what? John and Ann don't have sex anymore.
And Time Magazine calls it terrific. The season's smartest and funniest film.
Is it for me?
Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Is that for me?
Yeah, it's for you.
A Miramax Films release.
Yes, people thought Harvey Weinstein had eaten one too many corn dogs when he paid $1.1 million for Sex, Lies after a fierce bidding war. But it ended up making something like $25 million domestically. And the studios got to thinking that maybe they might like a slice of that. Disney made the first move when they bought Miramax in 1993, and in the next decade, every studio would buy or create their own mini-major. But now, after a few really spectacular successes and a few even more spectacular failures, it seems that many of the studios are backing away from what they call specialty films. Warner Brothers in particular is getting out of the business altogether. Why, and how has studios coming, and now going, changed independent film forever? Mark Gill was most recently the head of Warner Independent, where he bought that $8 million Penguin movie that made $127 million worldwide. He was previously the president of Miramax LA. Our host Claude Brodesser-Ackner spoke with Mark in the offices of his newest venture, the Film Department, a movie finance, production, and sales company he co-founded in 2007.
Mark Gill, welcome back to the business.
Thank you.
So let's define some terms here. Indie film.
Indie film used to mean anything the studios didn't make, and lately that's meant 5,000 films per year. Ironically, now the studios have co-opted a part of that, let's say it's 75 to 100 films a year, with their so-called independent divisions. And what they would prefer to call those movies is specialty films, because that means, not the other 4,900 indie films that are made in somebody's garage with a credit card, but the ones that you should go see because they have bigger stars in them, they're glossed up, and they're going to have more marketing dollars spent on them.
So why did the studios, the big studios, get into the specialty film business in the first place?
Well, cash, basically. Miramax was doing so well and taking up a lot of what, frankly, studios used to do. As studio movies got bigger and bigger, $100 million plus, they abandoned the smaller movies, the Amadeuses, the English Patients, all that sort of thing. And Miramax took The English Patient from Fox, for example, did very well with it. Took Shakespeare in Love from Universal, did very well with it. And they started to see, my God, there's a business there. We don't always have to pay top dollar.
So why are they getting out?
Well, some are, some aren't. Those that are getting out realized it's harder than it looks. It's probably twice as hard as making studio movies, and the economics are not that good unless you do well. There were too many independent films all at once, so they each cut each other down in size, and there were too many other films generally, so the market was just saturated.
So what is the studio's sort of misadventures in studio film done to indie film?
Well, arguably two things. I mean, probably you could say Paramount Vantage is the most responsible over the last 3 years for inflation in independent film, both in production and marketing costs. They spent a fair amount getting themselves on the block and made some good movies, and then spent a lot to market them, and it prompted most of their competitors to have to follow suit. So that was, I think, one of the big problems. But really the other big problem was just the massive glut of Wall Street funded and high net worth individual funded small movies that were just getting in the way. It was so hard to stand out, you had to spend more.
Now, I want to read you a little quote here from an old colleague of mine at Variety, Dade Hayes. He wrote this in August. I think it's probably still true if you agree with it or don't. I'd love to know. It's impossible to look at the box office without concluding the following. The worst thing that ever happened to indie film was that the studios thought it was a good business. Do you agree with that?
I don't agree with that, actually. I don't think it was the worst thing that ever happened to indie film. I think the worst thing that ever happened to indie film was greed. And greed on the part of filmmakers, greed on the part of studio executives, all the rest of it. Because if you look at what, let's say, Universal has done with Focus, they made that a far more viable company than it was when it was USA Films. If you look at what Fox has done with Fox Searchlight, really good. You look at the support that Sony's given Sony Classics over the year, really good. Some of the other studios that got into this and didn't do so well, not so good.
How did things get so out of hand so quickly? I'm thinking of an MPAA press release from 2006, where it says that the cost of marketing a specialty film has gone up 33% from 2005 to 2006. Is that the beginning of the end?
The MPAA statistics you cite about the increase in marketing costs are a little bit more skewed than they would appear to be. Here's why. They didn't used to include New Line in those figures, and then the year they showed the tremendous jump, they started including New Line. And New Line, of course, was releasing things like the Golden Compass and spending $80 million on marketing, so it really threw the figures. Mm-hmm. But having said that, they're much, much larger than they were 10 years ago. And the reason for that is pretty simple, which is if there are 600 films in theaters every year, as there have been the last 2 years, the only chance you have as an independent film is to be an event. You're not Batman, but you're one of the must-see films of that year. Last year it was the Coen Brothers film, and There Will Be Blood and two or three others. Every year there are a few of those. And those vying for that crown, trying to become that, have to go out and spend not only on the making of the movie, but also on the marketing.
As you see things, having worked both inside and outside and sort of in a hybrid of the studio system, is it possible for the studios to get this right, or has it left such a bad taste in their mouth that they're all more or less going to exit at some point?
I'll be really surprised if they all exit. I think about half of them will, and the other half will do very nicely. And some of that is a function of having figured out how to run those businesses. Some of it's partly having the right people working in them, so those people know how to do it. But a lot of it, frankly, is there's only room for so many movies every year. There's only room for so many companies. It used to be there were two or three or four companies that did that. Maybe there'll be five or six in the future, but there aren't going to be 12.
What to you is the lesson here? I mean, if there is a takeaway from all this for Hollywood, because there seems to be these cycles that become like paroxysms of insanity or fits or whatever you want to call it, seizures that come to Hollywood and strike the town. What's the lesson here?
I think the lesson here is make fewer better. I think it has been true since Sam Goldwyn said it in the 50s. We got really carried away with all the $18 billion in Wall Street money that came into Hollywood over the last few years. Independent films, there are now 5,000 a year made. About 100 of those get released, maybe. About 5 of them succeed. That gives you about a 99.9% chance of failure right now. That has to change. There's just too many people losing money. So really what it will come down to is, let's not make so many of them. Let's not waste so much money on things that never, ever are going to have a chance. Let's put out things that have a better chance. They can't all succeed. They won't. But the odds will be substantially better. And those that get through that narrowing process, I think, will be far more likely to have a shot.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to independent film maven Mark Gill about how the studios changed indie film forever. They got into the indie business big time over the last decade and now seem to be taking a step back.
What's the difference to the person who just goes to the movies and doesn't know, you know, what's going on in Hollywood or Wall Street for that matter? How is this going to manifest itself differently? Are we, you know, as we sit and munch our popcorn or our, you know, sage-infused turkey sausage at whatever high-end theater, because I'm very highbrow.
I can see that in you.
How will we see this, you know?
Well, the first and the best news is that there'll be far fewer movies in theaters. It will go from probably 600 a year now to about 300, which is where it should be.
And that's good news.
That's really good news because a lot of the movies on the margin will not get made. The second thing is that it also means that to the extent that you're thinking about going to a film on a weekend, you don't have to choose from 12, you have to choose from 6. And one of those is probably for teenage girls, and another one of those is the action movie you don't want to see. You've all of a sudden narrowed it down to 3 or 4. One of those is a tiny little art film you don't care about. Okay, you got a couple of choices this weekend, as opposed to now, you look on the internet or in the newspaper or wherever you look for showtimes, and there's 12 movies to sift through. It's untenable. That will not last. That's going to be gone within a year.
This might be a little bit outside your area of expertise, but I'm curious just to ask it anyway, since neither of us are critics. But with less money available, will we really get better movies?
I believe we will for two reasons. One of them is because what you're seeing more and more is the audience taking control of the process of how a movie opens. It used to be no matter how bad a movie was, you could open it to $7 or $10 million. Now they open to 1, maybe 2. the BlackBerry, the cell phone, the instant messengering, the texting, all that stuff catches up to movies now. And it catches up in a good way, too. Let's use The Devil Wears Prada as the classic example. All the surveys said it'll open to 15 million, but everybody sent an email to everybody or a text saying, go now, it's hilarious, you'll love it. And it did 30 million opening weekend and went on to be a runaway hit. So there is a democratization of movie-going response that is a function of technology that the studios can't outwit with marketing. Now, on the very big movies, the spectacles, they'll still do it, they'll be okay. But on everything else, you have to be better or you'll get killed.
I want to talk about sort of your experiences in studio-specialized film, and in particular, your experiences after them and immediately after them. So you were running Warner Independent Pictures, having previously been the president of Miramax in Los Angeles, and the studio never really gave you full autonomy as the head of Warner Independent Pictures. There was always some sort of bureaucratic layer above. And then when they replace you, after you had one of the most successful films of the year in March of the Penguins, they replace you with the woman who was in charge of the Scooby-Doo franchise for Warner Brothers. What does that say about what studios think about specialized film?
Well, I think what it says about what Warner's thinks about them is that they weren't quite sure how to tackle it. And in fairness, they're allowed to say that. They're allowed to say, we do Batman beautifully, and we work that really hard at that, and that's what we want to do. There are those who would say that that's always been true at Warner, just for the longest time. So fair enough. But to say that what Warner does is the equivalent of what, say, Disney does with Miramax, or Fox does with Searchlight, or Universal does with Focus is just not fair, because those three studios, and you could add Sony with Sony Classics, they run those divisions very nicely. They give them enough wiggle room. It works fine.
Mm-hmm. As you look at specialized film now, are the expectations just radically different? I mean, was too much expected of these movies?
I think their expectations are different all the way around. And again, that's a function of the audience has only got room for so many things in a day. So you either have to have a pretty big hit or you don't get through. It used to be an independent film, if it grossed $5 or maybe $10 million, not so bad. But now the marketing costs are so high, the making the cost of the movie is so high, $5 or $10 million, not so good anymore. That's the also-ran. It's not even a single anymore. It's a modest miss. So yeah, you need to be grossing $20, $30, $40 million. The expectations are much higher.
And they seem to be unrealistic.
Well, I don't think they're unrealistic, but they're harder to achieve. There will be a much narrower band of films that will get through.
Finally, the studios seem to have learned their lesson, and the lesson is greed doesn't pay. Are they able to absorb a more nuanced lesson, which is if you do this cheap and you do it with discipline, there is a business here.
Yes.
But why not learn that lesson? Is it simply too much trouble for too little money?
Well, there's no question that for some studios it was too much trouble for too little money. For those who are making a go of it, Fox, Universal, Sony, Disney, it's absolutely fine. They figured out how to do it.
But those are all the same sized conglomerates. I mean, they're all, shave off a billion here or a billion there, but they're all owned by Wall Street conglomerates, big media companies. Why have some decided to go through the trouble and others not?
I think it comes down to people, much as large corporations hate to say that. It really does come down to people. It comes down to the managers of those enormous companies and then the people that they hire to run the independent divisions. If those people have figured out how to work together and how to do something that's reasonably economic, then they keep doing it. And there are those who, you know, Warner Brothers is the perfect example. They understand big movies perfectly. And my experience was they never quite understood independent films, didn't particularly care that much about them. And as a consequence, for me, it was sort of a battle every day there.
Is it less fun now than it was when you started?
It's way less fun. It's just brutal. The economics are way worse. The amount you can lose is much more substantial. The amount of lawyers and agents who just beat your head in are far worse. Every last part of it is much harder than it used to be. I still like doing it, so and probably have no other skills in life, so I have to do it. But it is way less fun than it used to be.
Mark Gill is the former president of Miramax Films in Los Angeles, the former head of Warner Independent Pictures, and now the chairman of the film department, a Wall Street in part backed independent production outfit. We joined him in his offices in Los Angeles. Mark, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks so much.
The studio's foray into indie film started at the Sundance Film Festival. Coming up after a short break, we talked to two of the people slogging through thousands of Sundance entries to find the next Sex, Lies, and Videotape. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner. This year, the Sundance Film Festival received 9,000 entries in total. 3,400 of those were full-length features or documentaries. Think about that. That's about 6,800 hours of movies, and keep in mind there are only about 8,700 hours in an entire year. As we speak, a small army of first-line reviewers around the country are slogging through those thousands of hours of well-meaning cinema. They'll then send their thoughts to the Sundance staff to help them select the 125 feature-length films that'll be shown at the next festival in January. Now, if you think sitting in the dark and watching all those movies sounds like a dream job, you may change your mind after my conversation with John Cooper, the director of programming for the festival, and Trevor Groth, a senior programmer. John Cooper, Trevor Groth, thanks for joining us on The Business.
Thanks for having us.
You're coming towards the end of the screening process. How many movies have you each seen so far? John, start with you.
Oh, my God. I think I'm at a couple of hundred right now. I don't watch as many as Trevor anymore.
I think I've seen probably maybe about 400 at this point. I think I usually end up watching probably about, 500 or 600 feature films, and including, feature documentaries. And that's over the course of about 4 months.
My God, that's a lot of movies.
Yeah, it is.
And do you say, okay, from 3 to, 9 tonight, I'm going to be watching movies, and you watch them in serial fashion? Do you put your slippers on? How do you what are the practical logistics of the thing?
It's, more like 14 to 16 hour days. For a couple months. October and November is really our crunch time, when we're really busting our asses to get through all of these submissions. I try to waste as little time as possible, so I oftentimes don't leave my apartment for days on end, and I'm just sitting glued to my couch, watching submission after submission.
Now, obviously, the experience is different at home. There are distractions there. Do you turn off the phone? Do you turn down the lights? Do you put the sign on the door that says, do not disturb? Or are there just the life intrudes sometimes?
Oh, every once in a while, although, I'm pretty good at sort of shutting out, the outside world, and I think much to the dismay of my wife, who's, those months are not necessarily the best times for her.
For your relationship.
Our loved ones are used to this pattern, definitely.
Right.
But it's pretty much an all day, all through the weekend. We're just in it now. It's not, there's no time off. I start very early. I start sometimes 5:30, 5 in the morning. Because I'm just getting old, I can't stay up as late for some reason. So I'm like this kind of early watcher, and just go until I can't do it any longer, day after day.
So just kind of go over briefly, if you could, the process.
One thing we just all decided, sort of as an ethical thing, is we wanted all films watched by at least one person all the way through. So films go out to the first group, they're rated, they come in. Things with higher ratings, move up, and they just keep moving up. I'm sort of one of the last people to get films. They're even filtered by, Trevor and the rest of the staff here before they get to me, before our big meetings where we, argue everything out in the final.
Right. So basically, by the time you really get to the final meetings, you're dealing with what you see as the finest of the 2,400
right.
feature-length films that you've gotten. Trevor, what is it that you're looking for when you're watching a film? And is there a rating sheet?
Well, our associate programmers that we send out the first wave to, they fill out a coverage form, in essence, which does have their comments, their thoughts about the film, and also they give a rating to films. And so that batch then comes back to the programmers, who go through, and we watch all of the highest rated films first, and then we go through and we double check all of the low rated films as well to make sure that we agree with what they with what they said about the films.
Are they rating it with stars or smiley faces, or is there a number scale, or what is it?
It is a number scale. We just do like a 1 through 5 rating, and it's funny. You'd think that people could stick to a 1 through 5, but a lot of times people will give it like a 3.5. Sometimes a low score from the Russian judge.
Yeah. So I always say the hardest part about this job is really keeping yourself open.
Yeah.
It's not allowing yourself to go into that place where we're not critics. We we still have to find, you know, 125 features that make us excited, which is not the easiest thing every year.
No, and that's what I learned my first year of programming. I came into the process. I thought the job was to find the good films and weed out the bad films. And then I quickly learned from sort of the people that I was working with that it wasn't about that. It's about finding the good in every film you're watching. And then from those films that you watch, selecting the ones that will make the most complete program.
You're not picking films necessarily that you like, but that you think are worth being seen, which
yeah,
is different.
Yep.
You don't know what you're about to see, and when you see something that you haven't heard anything really about and it ends up being great, it's such a great experience.
That's what you're doing it for. You're addicted to the discovery. You know, and it makes you high, and it'll sustain you through all the rest of this. That's what keeps you watching.
John, in your 20 years of doing this, you've certainly seen films by filmmakers who were unknown at the time and who have become known.
Yeah.
Do you sometimes, in the back of your mind as you're watching movies, think to yourself, oh, my God, this is the next, you know, Quentin Tarantino? Or think to yourself, gee, this is a terrible film, but this guy has a vision. Or, gee, this film doesn't hold up completely, but the visual style is something I've never seen before. And you really focus on this person and think about what it is that they could become.
Yeah, I do, actually. I do think that way. I mean, I sometimes compare ourselves, like, you know, to baseball scouts where, you know, you go to, you know, to some minor league and you go, look at the arm on that guy, you know. That's kind of, you know, you're looking for a clear voice. And, you know, it shines through. And a lot of what we do that in is actually the shorts programs, which Trevor and I both, you know, cut our teeth in the shorts programs, which is where you really learn, you know, when you're watching, you know, 1,500, 2,000 films a year short, you know, they tend to just pop, you know. It's like the pure talent sort of pops. And yeah, a lot of times it is in a very flawed film, and you know that, and that's what you weigh when you make your final selections. That's what we argue about when we go into the room.
Can you take us into the room where you've gotten together, a couple of people have watched a film, and the conversation that you might have about whether the film should be programmed into the festival or not?
We get heated at times. We try not to get personal, but we get heated. But also, too, that we will argue sometimes just to argue points of a film. We'll argue different sides. Sometimes I argue against a film just because it seems like such a slam dunk. I want to make sure that everybody's not just, you know, in that mood to accept this film. I want to make sure that they're really comparing it to the other films.
Cinematic also, devil's advocate.
Yeah.
But have there been situations where somebody has said, you know what, if you like this film, you're an idiot, and the person has walked out and had to come back, and there was an apology and a hug, and can't we all get along?
I don't know if we go that far any longer. Maybe that was in the early years. We made people cry, but that's, you know, we're also raw at that point. Crying is not a scary thing.
It's really just more about the fact that you're exhausted and you've watched a lot of films.
Like I said, it's all part of the energy in there.
Now, having seen so many of these kind of serious films with some weight and heft, do you tend to want to just on Friday night go to the local Cineplex and see Armageddon 4?
No. Yeah.
John Cooper is the director of programming for the Sundance Film Festival. Trevor Groth is a senior programmer. They've both been at it for many, many years and seen many, many films. Thanks for all the hard work that you do to keep independent film alive, and thanks for joining us on The Business.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
The selections for this year's festival are expected to be announced around the first week of December. Memorial services for the programming staff will be held shortly after that. And that's The Business. I'm Matt Holzman, and I produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to our podcast, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com. And you can still subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. Our email is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Prodesser Ackner, and we'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.